It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Annie Feit, and today we are talking about bugs. They are the creatures everyone loves to hate in Alaska, but mosquitoes and other bugs are creating outside in the state, a very necessary part. Today we're going to talk about which bugs are out during which times of the year and how you can stay sane in skeeter country. And we're going to get beyond mosquitoes to talk about beetles, spiders, dragonflies, and other critters we encounter when we venture outside. My guests today are Derek Sykes, curator of insects at the University of Alaska Museum and associate professor of biology and wildlife at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Welcome, Derek.
Thanks.
And Janice Chumley, who is an integrated pest management technician with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service. She's based in Soldotna. Hi, Janice.
Good afternoon.
And let's start with something that's probably on everyone's mind right now. Janice, what is this going to be a bad summer for mosquitoes? Do you have any predictions on that?
You know, it doesn't matter where you are. Everybody always thinks it's a bad summer for mosquitoes. We had a fairly mild winter, good snow cover, plenty wetness around in the last fall. So there's already quite a few mosquitoes out. I was working in the yard this past weekend and got bit pretty good. So sure, it's going to be a great year for skeeters.
What do you think, similar to last summer, which people also talked about as being a bad year?
I would assume so.
Okay, so get ready. In Alaska, do we do much in terms of controlling mosquitoes? You know, like,
you mean as far as a statewide?
Yeah,
effort?
The state.
No.
Or and why?
No.
Is that?
Our state is a huge state, first of all, and the waters that mosquitoes breed in are everywhere. Boy, mosquitoes are just part of the food chain, and it would be not wise to think about poisoning just for a nuisance insect, not when it creates so much food for birds, migratory bird species, and fish. There's all the waters in the state of Alaska are under the venue of the Department of Environmental Conservation, and you need to get a permit to do any water applications in the state. And there is only one place that I'm aware of that does any kind of mosquito control, and that's in the Valdez area.
Oh, and do you know why that is?
They have a permit, and they feel that, you know, it works for them and their specific situation. But large scale, it would be cost prohibitive and probably ecologically unbalanced to think about controlling mosquitoes. There's more of them than there is of us, so we should get used to that idea.
Yeah, and Derek, do we know how many more of them there are than there are of us?
Yeah, probably billions of pounds more. We did some fairly simple calculations based on work done on spider kill rates and ended up with an estimate of 13 billion pounds of insects killed by spiders in Alaska every year.
Wow.
Now, that's not all mosquitoes, but there's a fair number of mosquitoes and other nuisance insects in that poundage. And those are just the ones that are killed by spiders. So, I mean, if you dislike spiders, you have to realize that they're helping keep down the nuisance flies. It's definitely a lot.
Yeah, were you surprised by that calculation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we calculated that the moose population in Alaska is about 250 million pounds. So the insects killed by spiders is well over 10 times... I mean, it's just an enormous amount, and we don't really know what percent the spiders are actually taking. It's probably like 20% or less. So you really have to calculate, that, you know, another, I don't know, 3 or 5 fold more than the 13 billion to get to the total poundage of biomass of insects in Alaska.
That is a lot of poundage.
Mm-hmm. Base of the food chain, yeah. Yeah, very much so.
How many different types of mosquito species do we have here?
We calculate about 34. Some are very rare. People aren't going to find them. In most places, you're probably not going to have more than a dozen or so. And there are seasons. So you get this sort of winter mosquito, early spring emergence of these larger, slow species in the genus Culicida that are adult overwinterers. So they spend the entire winter as adults hiding out. And then you get the much smaller Aedes and other species coming out in the midsummer. So it's, yeah, it's quite the onslaught.
And how different are those different species? Are some of them quicker to bite, or do all of them
yeah,
bite?
Yeah, well, some are bird specialists and don't bite people at all. So they're not all equally nuisance to people, that's for sure. And some have different preferences of where they lay eggs, different habitat preferences. But I don't think we have a very detailed understanding of the life history and ecological preferences of all the species. So it's that's just one of many of the unknowns we have about the insects of Alaska.
Can you tell just by looking at a mosquito which kind it is? Some of them?
So you can do that to a very gross scale. Like I mentioned, these larger, slower ones in the spring, you can easily tell what genus they are. But to tell what species they are, you have to get them under the microscope. And you have to do that without damaging them, and that's kind of tricky. Mosquitoes are very fragile things, and getting one, killing one without hurting it, damaging its body, because you have to actually be able to see the patterns of scales on the wings and the sides of the body at high magnification in order to identify the species.
And what do they look like under the microscope? Are they...
Oh, they're fascinating. I mean, any insect under the microscope is astonishingly complex. I mean, imagine a bird or a cat. It's just, we have this very big problem of being giants among the animal world. I mean, we tend to think of ourselves as normal size, but most animals are smaller than a dime. And so we're really these big, big creatures, and we don't appreciate the complexity of these tiny things because we can't see them. They're kind of too small for our eyes. So entomologists are this lucky group that get to look at these things under microscopes all the time, and you see this enormous complexity, beautiful patterns of scales and hairs. My grad student the other day was astonished. He was looking at a beetle he's working on, and the compound eyes had hairs emerging from in between the different omatidia or facets of the eye. So you have this large eye with all these different omatidia, and these long hairs coming out in the eye itself, which was he had taken entomology and he'd never seen anything like that before. It was really exciting. And there's always exciting things we see practically every day in the lab.
And what are those hairs for? Do we know?
Well, they're often sensory. Some are hairs are more of have a cleaning function or preventing of a fouling to prevent debris from accumulating or getting stuck in joints. But sometimes they're sensory or even thermoregulatory, meaning helping to retain body heat, like we see that in bumblebees a lot.
And what about the flies in Alaska? Are a lot of them biting flies? Are there other biting pests?
No, flies as a group are the biggest group of insects in Alaska. In the world, there's only four really giant groups of insects. You've got your beetles, your wasps, bees and ants, your moths and butterflies, and your flies. So those four groups make up like 90% of the species, but the biggest group of all is the beetles, with three times as many as any of the other groups alone. But in Alaska, that's not the case. Beetles aren't the biggest group. Flies are. I think we have over 1,800 species of flies in Alaska. Now the biting flies, the ones that bite, that drink blood, vertebrate blood, are probably less than 10% of that total. It's really a small chunk of the big pie.
And are those black flies? What are they?
Black flies are one of the groups that feed on blood. Horse flies are another one. The mosquitoes, obviously, and the noceums, this group called the Cerata begonids, which are small enough to fly through a lot of mosquito netting and quite a nuisance to people who think that mosquito netting is going to keep them safe from biting flies.
Just because they're so small.
Yeah.
Thus the name.
Yeah.
Janice, what is your least favorite biting insect in Alaska?
I'm with Derek. I really don't like no-see-ums. I react badly to them and wind up getting swollen welts that are fairly annoying.
And they're hard to defend yourself against?
Well, because of the size, they tend to creep under the cuffs that you have, your long cuffs of your sleeves, or they get in around your neck. Your hairline is very exposed to them. And sadly, it seems that the only deterrent that you have available to you is to use a repellent. And, you know, you can't really drench yourself in pesticides. So I find them pretty annoying.
What kind of repellent do you use, or do you try to avoid them altogether?
Well, timing is everything. They're not active all the time, and so it depends on when you recreate and where you recreate, because if you can avoid some of the water areas, sadly, you know, you usually get bit when you're going fishing. And so if you can avoid your timing so that you don't expose yourself when they are most active. I wear a bug jacket, which seems to help me somewhat, and I'm a firm believer in bug jackets. There are a number of repellents that are available. Before this call, I looked on the DEC's website. There are 1,600 registered mosquito controls in the state of Alaska, and they range from a variety of things like an aerosol that you would use around the home to mosquito attractants to the little coils that people utilize. So there's lots of different ways, and with no-see-ums, it's kind of the same thing, you know. You pick the one that works best for the situation you're in and try to avoid contact with them.
But you don't have a favorite?
My bug jacket is my best friend.
Mm-hmm. Is that like a mosquito netting jacket?
Yes, it is. And the pants, too. Mm-hmm. And then you tuck your pant legs in to your socks and, you know, wear boots.
Mm-hmm. Derek, do you have one of those?
I do use the mosquito head nets and, you know, obviously long sleeves and such. But I've become fond of these insect shield, permethrin, coated shirts. Mm-hmm. They're almost like a cloak of invisibility. I mean, you don't have to worry about applying any lotions or creams or sprays, and you just put on this shirt and you're good to go. It's pretty nice.
And what is actually on the shirt to keep the bugs?
It's an insecticide called permethrin that's very low toxicity to mammals, but is a neurotoxin to insects, and they just keeps the mosquitoes and other biting insects away.
And where do you buy that?
Different. You can buy sprays that you can apply, but there's a company that I've used, Ex Officio. They make pretty high end outdoor clothing, and they sell clothing that has this embedded in it. It's good for the lifetime, as long as you don't dry clean the clothing. It'll persist.
Shirts and pants, I know that's getting to be a little bit more well-known. Lots of outdoor stores carry that, just to SP 50 clothing and mosquito repellent at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And the military are using it, too, for their troops.
Yeah. Huh.
And what about, I can't remember what these things are called, but they sold out of stores in town last year. They're little, like, discs that with fans that blow some sort of thing. It's like a palm. What's it? Bug mister, maybe?
No, unfamiliar with that.
No? Okay. Yeah.
The ones I'm familiar with that do that tend to use it's a plant-based repellent it's the scent is supposedly not good for insects. They don't like it, and it's based on geranol, which is a geranium extract. Whether it works or not, I could not say. I'm not giving up my bug jacket for it. I know that. Mm-hmm.
One of the most effective ways of cutting down malaria transmission in Africa is mosquito netting. Just having everybody sleep in mosquito netting.
So Janice, you haven't found anything that beats the bug jacket?
No, not at all. I have not. And it's one of those things that it's lightweight, it's easy to put in your backpack, carry with you, put on your body, it lets air through, and it works well. You don't have to worry about any kind of reaction, a chemical that you might be applying. You know, you can use it for little kids and not worry about, you know, if they're going to have a bad reaction to it. I like the bug jacket.
We did have one question from a listener about how to protect kids from mosquitoes. Do either of you give out recommendations on that? Whether bug repellent is okay for kids, or what good alternatives?
I think Janice's advice is great on that count. I sometimes see kids applying spray like a DEET insecticide. Repellent. Almost as a precautionary measure before they even like leave the house. And I think this is greatly overkill and potentially unsafe. It really should be used only if needed. And you have to spend some time outside to see how bad the insects are before you would make that decision. But the bug jacket doesn't need any repellents or chemicals, so it's much safer.
When dealing with children, you know, they are far more at risk to any of the chemical exposures that might occur. And as Derek said, you know, you got to be outside to see if you even need it at first. I know there's a lot of products out there. People want to keep their kids safe, but, you know, there's a lot of things to do. DEET has been overused, I think, and you can have a lot of harm from overuse of any pesticide. And so if a person's choice is to use any kind of repellent, they need to read the label. It's really important, and I cannot stress that enough. The label is the law. It's there for your safety. It's there for the safety of others, and you need to follow the directions that are on there. Even if they're in that little fine print, you need to read it, because it's put there just not only to make the product work better, but to ensure that it's done in a safe manner.
And we're lucky in Alaska, too, because we don't have any diseases transmitted to humans from insects or ticks.
Yay!
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's none.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that?
We're lucky so far. I mean, the harsh climate probably is the primary reason, but it may change over time. West Nile virus is a minor problem, but it is spreading in the lower 48 in Canada, and the Lyme disease as well is a mm-hmm. huge problem. Rocky Mountain spotted fever from ticks. We're really lucky to be free from all that.
But do you think it is only a matter of time before those diseases are up here?
Yes.
Any predictions on how long that will take?
I could put my money on 50 years.
50 years, really?
Yep.
Okay, mm-hmm. So we have a while.
I think so. But we may get unlucky, I don't know.
Do you agree with that, Janice?
Sure. If you think about how things are spread, we have a large migratory bird population. We have a changing climate. There are becoming... You find ticks not only on the snowshoe hares and squirrels, say, that you used to see, but now there's been ticks found on dogs and cats that you never used to see before. So things change, things move, and that's pretty much just how disease and the vectors for those gets around. So I'm with Derek. I don't know. I'm not a betting person, though, so I'm not going to give you a year as to when mm-hmm. it's going to show up. But sooner or later, I'm sure it will.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break here. The people who live on the doorstep of Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve know a thing or two about living in bug country. Our producer, Monica Gokey, checked in with Gary Hanchett, the mayor of Bettles, a small town right outside the park. He said, "We called at the right time. The mosquitoes are just beginning to show up in force." You're listening to Outdoor Explorer, and I'm Annie Feit.
If you go north, about 15 hours north to be precise, you'll find yourself on the doorstep of Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. It's huge, about the size of Belgium. And some of its most notorious residents just might be the mosquitoes.
the big ones are the ones that show up first, and they're big and stupid. They'll light on you and sit there and, you know, contemplate what they're going to do and be ready for a good slap. It's the little ones that come. They should start showing up next week.
That was Gary Hanchett. Among other jobs, like trapper, postal worker, and guide, Gary is the mayor of Bettles, a community on the fringes of Gates of the Arctic. For about 2 months a year, the mosquitoes come in thick, and it changes things in the community of Bettles.
Oh, I've got a cat, and he has to protect his nose and around his eyes. And so as a result, he sleeps with a paw over his face.
Is it normal to just see your cat outside swatting at things you can't see, just looking like a crazy animal?
Yeah, and people do that too, myself included.
Gary actually insists that the locals are pretty used to bug season, a bug season considered heinous by South Central standards.
You wear light-colored clothing, for one thing. Dark-colored clothing and real bright, dark colors. You're a magnet for them at that point. So you wear light-colored clothing, long-sleeve shirts, of course.
You do your outdoorsy stuff during the day, not at dusk, Gary says, and don't go anywhere without your bug spray. Bug season is not a big deal.
You do get used to it.
Visitors, on the other hand, don't always fare as well.
It's something to behold if you're not prepared. And every year there's people who show up and you can tell them apart because they're swinging and swatting and usually using language that we won't be using today.
But before you start thinking that the bugs are the big bad bullies of the North, Gary is quick to point out that they're pretty integral to Arctic ecosystems.
A lot of people look at salmon as the root, the baseline for organic life and so on, particularly in the Arctic. But really, it's the mosquito. You know, their larva is food for young fish and other insects, dragonflies, you know. They serve a purpose other than being a pest.
One thing Gary likes about living in the far north is not having a ton of people around. Maybe it's the bugs that put people off, but maybe not. Maybe it's the remoteness, maybe not. Regardless, this is the Alaska that Gary loves.
I use the expression, the only way I can portray how beautiful it is say that it stops time for me. And you look out and, you know, you just... you're out there and there's nothing around you. It seems to stop the clock.
For Outdoor Explorer, I'm Monica Gokey.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Annie Feit, and today we're talking about bug season. Our guests include Janice Chumley from the UAF Cooperative Extension Service and Derek Sykes, curator of insects at the University of Alaska Museum. You like to call bugs charismatic microfauna, which I love, but sell me on that.
Well, the majority of them are harmless to people and probably quite helpful to the ecosystems we love so much, as was mentioned about the dependence of salmon on mosquito larvae. It's been said that if you took all the insects out of an ecosystem, most of it would collapse. You would lose so much. So And in terms of them being charismatic, I think in part that requires you getting to know them. You have to not just understand what they look like, which requires magnification, and then you start appreciating the complexity of their bodies, but their ecology, their behavior. I always like to show my students these great courtship rituals that jumping spiders use. The male jumping spider, they're very visual spiders. They have great big eyes. And the males have to do a dance, a courtship dance for the females, and impress them before the female will mate with them. And these dances are so elaborate. They have these multicolored appendages that they swing around, first to the left, first to the right. They run forward, they run back. They do all this really elaborate dance routine that when you see this, it kind of breaks down the barriers between the insect world and the human world. I mean, we're not that different ourselves. So I think they're very charismatic.
And is it intimidating, though, when you look at just the, as an entomologist, look at the so many different species that are out there to study? I mean, how do you kind of wrap your head around that?
It's a little intimidating, but it's mostly enthralling. I mean, it's the diversity is so enormous. And that's one of the major drives of my whole career has been in this field of systematics in entomology, which is looking at documentation of biodiversity on Earth, working out the relationships of species and determining how many species there are in different groups, where they occur, how they got there. The strange thing is we've been documenting species since Linnaeus's time over 200 years now, and it's we're very short of even hitting the halfway point. Some of the best estimates, we have a little over 1 million or so species, maybe 1.5 million species named of all life on Earth now. We don't have a full list, unfortunately. It's kind of scattered information. But the best estimates are coming out at anywhere from 8 to 30 million species for the planet, you know, and it's so when you go down into the tropics, which is where most of this stuff, most of the diversity is, you're finding very large numbers of undescribed species, and it's just really exciting. I mean, these are things that have been evolving on Earth for millions of years that people have never seen before, and some of them are just fascinating creatures.
So
I have one sort of slight misgiving that it sort of I was thinking about the other day in Alaska in particular. We don't have a great diversity here, and it's conceivable that in my lifetime I could document and find, you know, virtually all of the species that occur here. And so every time I find a species in Alaska that no one else has found before, it's very exciting for me, but no one else can find that for the first time. You know, it's a one-time thing. And so it's sort of, there's a certain sadness about like making the world so well known that there's nothing left to discover. It's not a huge sadness because there's almost an infinite complexity to life that I'm sure even, you know, the basics of figuring out which species are where is, we've got a lot more to work on, like what they do ecologically and behaviorally, their neurochemistry. I mean, there's any number of different things you could investigate.
But it sounds like entomology feels like an area where you can really be a true explorer and, like you said, find new species all the time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, we find new species on my own property. I mean, I'm writing a paper I just finished yesterday describing some new true bug species. Well, they're not new to science, but they're new for Alaska. And I was looking through the list, and I noticed that about of these 27 species in the paper, about 5 of them were found in my backyard.
Just you were out there collecting?
Yeah, I'm always collecting, yeah. So, like, it's just a habit of mine. And so the museum has a lot of specimens from my property.
And what kind of bug is it?
These are true bugs. So this is an order of insect that they have piercing, sucking mouth parts. So you might know... like a stink bug, for example, is a true bug. A bed bug is a true bug. And we do have bed bugs up here in Alaska. that's one of the ones on the list, actually, because it's, even though it's sort of well known that we have bed bugs, it hasn't been published in the scientific literature yet that they occur in Alaska.
Oh, wow. So Janice, how did you get into entomology?
Well, I have the pleasure of being an IPM tech, and integrated pest management deals with insect pests, plant pests, disease pests, vertebrate pests, except for humans. You're on your own there. But it's part of the job, and it's part of the IPM training. And that deals with pests, whether they're in the forest or whether they're in your garden or on your trees, or, you know, there's a huge variety of things that people consider to be pests. And so it's part of the job, and it's really interesting. As Derek said, life under the microscope is really a different world. For me, it's where science fiction comes from. It's really no surprise that, you know, when you look at the science fiction creatures, if you've ever done any time looking at things under a microscope, you know where they got those ideas from.
Mm. And do you, what kinds of questions, I guess, do you get from folks calling in about bugs?
Oh, lots about aphids. You know, with people growing food, growing vegetables, you get a lot of aphid questions, and aphids are all over birch trees typically, so you get just what are they, how come they're just only green or they're black, or a lot of just folks don't understand that aphids come in multiple colors and they all have the same sucking mouth parts. And then my favorite one is I work with children a lot, do bug classes, and we just exploring to see what's under the log, what kinds of things are helping to decompose this log that fell down. You know, what kind of bugs might be doing that? A lot of questions on carpenter ants, which is always interesting for the homeowner. And I've worked with John Hudson on dragonflies. He wrote a book, Dragonflies in Alaska, and dragonflies are really interesting creatures. That's our state insect, as a matter of fact.
The dragonfly?
Yeah, the four-spotted skimmer is our state insect. Most folks would think it is the mosquito, but they would be wrong.
And so tell me about the four-spotted skimmer.
Well, dragonflies live, hey, where mosquitoes live, what do you know? And they tend to eat a lot of mosquito larvae. They have, if you've ever held a dragonfly in your hand, you realize that when they're holding on to something, it's almost like they have Velcro on their feet, which helps them to just snatch things when they're flying midair and then eat them. Just beautiful creatures.
Yeah, what are their coloration?
Well, dragonflies and damselflies come in a huge variety of colors, from beautiful emerald green to turquoise blue to your typical brown, black. They're iridescent and quite lovely.
But is the force?
The wings on the dragonfly of the four-spotted skimmer, the veins are very pronounced. And then you see a specific spot on each wing that gives it that four spots, because they have two sets of wings.
Derek, do we know how many species of bugs we have in Alaska, or I guess how many have been cataloged so far?
Our list is a little over 8,000 right now.
And how is that a lot? I mean, how does that compared to?
Well, it's certainly a lot. It takes a long time to, say, build a collection with that many species. I mean, I've been working pretty heavily, and before I arrived in 2006, there was a sizable collection from our prior curator, Jim Cruz, who had achieved some donations. And altogether, the museum has representation of about 2,700 species. So we've been working very, very hard since the collection began in the year 2000, when Jim started it. So 14 years of work, we've got 2,700 species represented, and we have close to 200,000 specimens. So that's that's 14 years of work, 200,000 specimens, 2,700 species. Now, if that's the rate, you know, how long will it take us to get to 8,000? Species. It's going to be many, probably a couple more decades before we even get close. And that's assuming we can maintain the same effort, and that's assuming that all of the species are equally catchable, as it were. And the rare ones are certainly not, so they take a lot more effort than the common ones. It's compared to other states, it's a much lower diversity, which was one of the things I found appealing about Alaska. Not just the fact that it's mostly unknown. I like coming to a place that, you know, it's got this certain adventurous, north to the future aspect to it of undocumented biodiversity. But other states that I know well, like Oregon, a good comparison, they have over 25,000 species of insects. And so with our 8,000, they're 25,000, they're a much smaller state, but lower latitude, you get incredibly high diversity. And the closer you get to the equator, the diversity is just enormous. I mean, the country of Costa Rica, which is probably, I don't know quite the size, but it's a very small portion of Alaska in land area, is got probably 10 to 20 times as many species, if not many more. It's just incredible what you see in the tropics.
Is it just latitude that explains the fact that we don't have as many?
That's an age-old question, actually. A lot of PhD students are given that question on their comprehensive exam to see how well they can answer it. One of the answers has to do with glaciers, the northern latitudes being repeatedly sort of reset to zero by these enormous glaciations. It does have an effect on the diversity, for sure, because the communities have to rebuild every 10,000 years. Whereas you go down to the equator and you have a lot less of that disturbance. But there's also aspects of heat, you know, basic energy, and diversity tends to beget diversity. So you get this, the more species you have, the more niches are available for more species. So it's because species feed on each other, right? So, and live among and within each other. So it's, you just get this much greater complexity if you have a ecosystem that's undisturbed for a long time.
How many species are represented in the, what are some of your favorite species in the collection?
Oh, well, my favorite group of beetles is the one I did my doctoral work on, which are, they're called burying beetles. They're very insects because they're kind of like vertebrates. They have a small brood size, about 12 to 14 offspring at a time. And the reason they're called burying beetles is because they bury a small vertebrate like a mouse or a bird in the ground. As a male-female pair will work together, you know, cooperating to bury this thing and make a crypt underground. And they'll take all the fur off or the feathers if it's a bird, and then they'll raise their young in that crypt, with giving them parental care, and not just by the mother, but the father's down there too. That's very unusual reproductive strategy for insects. Most of them are just they mate. Oftentimes the male is useless and just dies almost soon after mating, and the female then can lay hundreds of eggs, and usually gives them no parental care whatsoever. So it's they're very engaging to me.
And are those characteristics unique at all to Alaska, or is it just?
No. That group of beetles is found in primarily the northern hemisphere, but worldwide. We have three species of them in Alaska, and I'm going to be studying one of them this summer rather closely because it's I think. There's one species that may very well be two. It's been heavily researched and assumed to be one species, but I'm going to test the hypothesis that it's actually two species.
So you think it might be two?
Yeah, I've got preliminary results that suggest that, but I'm going to do some further work to confirm it or reject the hypothesis if the case may be.
Okay, and Janice, I wanted to talk about beneficials. Which bugs get that label and why?
Bugs that eat bugs that we perceive as pests are considered beneficials. So dragonflies would be beneficial. One of my favorite ones are predaceous diving water beetles because they're big and they have that wow factor, and they eat a lot of other mosquito larvae. They'll also eat little tiny fish and a variety of other things. But beneficial insects would be ones that would help us if we're growing a garden and we were to release the very common ladybird beetle. You know, everybody's fairly familiar with them and that they would eat aphids. So we have a native lacewing that does the same thing, that is, it eats aphids, which are considered to be a pest for food crops. So we have a number of native things that native insects that eat other bugs that are considered to be beneficial, and then we tend to import them as well. Things like parasitic nematodes that would feed on root maggot larvae in your garden, or you can order green lacewings, or everybody knows about praying mantids, and those guys are considered to be a beneficial insect, even though they eat everything.
And those are imported?
Yeah, you buy an egg and you hatch it out, and it just eats everything that it can find. And it's a good thing that they're small, because if they were 6 feet tall, we would all be really afraid.
Do you worry about importing some bugs?
I think that in some ways it's you have to be cautious about what you're doing. I don't think that people import insects just for the heck of it like they do with other invasive things. I do think that you can only purchase beneficial insects from different companies that rear them or raise them, and they cost a lot. Most so, you wouldn't just do it for the heck of it on a whim. I do think that you have to be fairly careful about what it is that you're buying, and make sure that you understand how that if you introduce something into your greenhouse as a control, it's not going to eliminate something. It's going to reduce it to a tolerable level for you and for your crop. And so that is the whole idea behind using beneficial insects, is it reduces the pest pressure down to something that you can live with, I suppose. So they're good guys. And I don't think that we really, you know, our winters tend to wipe out a lot of things that would maybe be, I don't think that things would run amok. Like, I don't think you'll get too many lacewings in our, you know, in our ecosystems by releasing some of them. I think the winter tends to kill them.
I agree. We've been looking at the non-native species of insects in Alaska, and it's a very small list compared to other states. They have a hard time establishing here.
That sounds like a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, it's time for another quick break. In the run-up to the show, we put a photo on Facebook from Tundra Bug Season last summer and got more than 2,000 hits. One person wrote, OMG, I would go nuts. The photo was from Columbia University researcher Shannon Sweet. Our producer, Monica Goki, caught up with Shannon to see how this year's field season work is going. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Annie Feit.
Shannon Sweet is YouTube famous. A 25-second video she posted of mosquitoes in the Arctic tundra last year went viral. The Huffington Post wrote an article about it. The title read, "Horrifying Alaskan Mosquito Swarm Engulfs Scientists Who Record God-Awful Phenomenon." Here's a snippet.
Holy shit. All right, yeah. They're, like, biting any piece of skin that I'm showing.
Shannon and her colleagues sling 10 to 14-hour days during their summer field season. They see a lot of bugs. Shannon is a PhD candidate from Columbia University, and she is actually up there to work on the plants. Her research is focused on documenting how climate change is affecting the growing season and what time of year plants are emerging. Up at the Tulik Field Station on the North Slope, access to a phone line is spotty, but Shannon checked in with us through email. She sent some pictures of life on the tundra. Shannon basically looks like an REI/beekeeper version of Nurse Ratchet. She's got the bug head net, Gore-Tex pants, and latex gloves over her hands, which she says the bugs can't bite through. You can see a picture of her in full getup on our website at alaskapublic.org. Last year was especially bad for mosquitoes. Shannon attributes it to a cocktail of factors: rain, snow, unusually warm temperatures, a mix of factors that combine to make the perfect swarm. Oops, perfect storm.
Oh my God, the whole horizon is just nothing but mosquitoes as far as the eye can see.
For Outdoor Explorer, I'm Monica Gokey.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Annie Feit, and today we're talking about bug season. Our guests are Janice Chumley from the UAF Cooperative Extension Service and Derek Sykes, Associate Professor of Biology and Wildlife at UAF. And Derek, I wanted to talk a little more about spiders in Alaska. I've heard a lot of people ask if we have brown recluse or black widow spiders here.
We don't, thankfully. We have had some black widows brought into the museum. They were in shipping containers. Somebody brought a bunch of tires from California, thought he saw a black widow, and indeed it was. He brought in a nice live specimen. And when it comes to these kinds of spiders, it's very important to have specimens. It's really the only way to verify that you have what you think you have. Both of them are medically dangerous. The black widow has a very painful venom that could cause you to go to the hospital. The brown recluse, apparently most bites are asymptomatic, but it does have causes a necrotic lesion, which would be a wound that wouldn't heal. And we have yet to find any brown recluse in Alaska. People have not been able to find any specimens. We have a number of great people in cooperative extension who are constantly interacting with the public about spiders. We have a number of graduate students who are spider specialists who've been collecting spiders all around the state, and that's something I do as well. And we're very interested in, it would be very exciting to document the first brown recluse in Alaska, but it has yet to happen. Now, that doesn't mean people haven't claimed to have been bitten by brown recluse. That has happened a fair bit. But the odd thing is that unless you have the spider to demonstrate it was actually a brown recluse that bit you and caused the wound, it's much more likely the wound was caused by something else. Even if you see a spider when you first notice the wound, this doesn't mean that the wound was caused by the spider. And that's a common problem. In California is a great example. They have thousands of people diagnosed in the medical literature or databases as spider bites, as brown recluse bites, every year. But there's no brown recluse living in California. They're just not there. So these wounds are probably caused by other things like bacterial infections of various kinds, like MRSA, or diabetic ulcers are a very common one. But the medical community and the entomological community have been, there's a bit of a gap between, information gap between the two of them.
And do you hear from people who are just adamant that we do have brown recluse up here?
I do, yeah. Sometimes I give talks to the public and I have somebody say, you don't know, telling me I don't know what I'm talking about and that, they definitely were bit by a brown recluse. And I of course, I want to believe them, but in order to really prove this, you need to have the spider, and it needs to be identified by someone who can authoritatively identify brown recluse. It can't be just, from a photograph or something.
Janice?
Oftentimes, I think it's important for people to understand that our body chemistries are different. If you get stung by a bee, some people swell up and have to go to the hospital, and some people it doesn't bother at all. So our chemistries are all different, and it's easy to want to say, I was bit by this spider that is horrid and I know it. But as Derek said, without having a specimen that is biting you that you can positively take to have identified, you don't know, and your body chemistry may just react to a variety of things that causes it to have this painful area. And oftentimes it's easy to say, oh, it's a spider bite, when it could be any number of things.
And there's a lot of things that would rather bite you than spiders, as we've already talked about.
Yeah.
The horse flies, black flies, mosquitoes, bed bugs, all kinds of stuff. They actually want to drink your blood, but spiders don't want to do that.
So their biting is a defense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are there
Look
any
at the
other
size difference? You know, you got to look like a giant to a spider.
Yeah. Are there any other big bug myths in Alaska to dispel?
There's no ticks. People say there's no ticks. Yes, there are ticks.
Mm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's ticks on the seabirds quite heavily. The nesting, like out in the coast, and the Aleutians, the auklets, and others. There's huge numbers of ticks out there in those birds, and the people who study the birds sometimes get the ticks on them. But it's really rare for the general public to ever get exposed to those ticks.
Are there ticks?
There's ticks on hares too, on the rabbits. Yeah, so they're around, but they don't get on our pets very much because we have, as Janis mentioned, we do have a couple cases of these lower 48 species that are turning up. And if anybody does find ticks on their pets, they should get them to the museum or Quaffen Extension or Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Kimberly Beckman she's managing kind of a tick database for Alaska.
Because those are probably a different species of ticks that we don't have up here?
If they're on our pets, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are they all across the state, ticks in general?
No. No. I mean, the seabird ticks are definitely localized in the coast and where the seabirds are. The wildlife ticks are really restricted to where the wildlife is prevalent and the hares, that kind of thing. So.
Okay.
Yeah, far from where people live, usually.
Yeah. And what, Janis, do you get a lot of calls about defoliating insects? And what, are there big problems with defoliating insects in Alaska right now?
Oh, the last couple of years here on the Kenai Peninsula, we have had a large outbreak of defoliators that are munching through alders and willow, and it's very noticeable. There's pockets that when the trees leaf out that suddenly their leaves are gone, and it's been a concern. The Forest Service has taken a number of samples to try to figure out what kind of geometrid moths these might be, why their population has increased so. And usually with a buildup like that, that population crashes just as rapidly as it builds up. And sadly, most people don't care about the alders that they're being munched on. But, yeah, we get a lot of calls either from idle curiosity, people noticing something and going, wow, what did that? Or homeowners because it's affecting their landscape trees.
Okay. And Derek, we don't have a ton of time left, but I definitely wanted to talk about Casatochi Volcano, a big research project for you. Can you kind of describe how that came about?
Yeah, sure. So in 2008, I was working for Fish and Wildlife Service. They were interested in doing insect surveys in the Aleutians. And so it was very exciting for me. I'd never been out there before and going from island to island and sampling these islands, which are just phenomenally beautiful properties. Coincidence had, I was on Casatochi for 11 hours in June, and that same year, 2 months later, it erupted. It was a surprise to everyone, not the least of which were the two biologists who were on the island, and were luckily able to get off in time. But the eruption increased the size of the island by 40%, burying it in some places up to 800 meters of ash. And we all assumed that all life was extinguished on the island. It just sounded like it was going to be a pile of mud for many decades. We found, much to our surprise, the next year on the beaches there was insect life, and each year thereafter the number of species that I was finding, because we've been going back every year, has been increasing slowly, and it's just fascinating to see this ecosystem like slowly rebuilding itself. You know, first everyone thinks that the first basis of an ecosystem is the plant life. First you get the sort of the vegetation comes in, and then you get the things that feed on the vegetation. But that's not the way it seems to work with all of these volcanic systems and even glacial systems. When an ecosystem is reset to zero, the first thing that seems to appear is scavengers and then predators that feed on the scavengers. Now, what are the scavengers feeding on? they're feeding on dead stuff. And on Cassatoche, it's mostly fish and bird carcasses and seaweed coming out of the, kelp coming out of the ocean. So there's this huge influx of marine organic matter, and there's all these decomposers feeding on that, these scavengers. And then there's all these predator insects feeding on those. So you get this very kind of complex and interesting ecosystem that's got no plant life in it. But now we're beginning, like in year four, we found our first herbivores. Some aphids were feeding on some plants because some roots had survived and plants were starting to come back. Little patchy areas here and there, you get these little communities, what they call kind of gardens, because they look like there's, 50 different individual plants of maybe 5 species or 10 species kind of mixed together in this small area. But most of the island is still just barren ash fields and slopes, lots of erosion constantly.
And are there certain spots on the island where you are finding that life coming back?
Yeah, so I kind of break it into 3 areas. The beach was the first one where we noticed all this stuff happening on the beach with the kelp and the dead fish. But then you get these small gardens. So those are other kind of hot spots where you get predators and scavengers, but also some of these herbivores are beginning to appear. But then the latest hot spot I just found is having to do with bird colonies. So Cassatoche used to have 250,000 auklets living on it. In these big talus slopes, they nest among the rocks, and they're returning. I don't know what their numbers are now. I don't really keep up with the bird numbers, but there was a lot of erosion opened a new set of talus, and perhaps it was a kind of a collapse as well that created this talus. But the net effect is in the last year, and this was in 2013, we were able to get into this auklet colony that was so rich with life. I just hadn't seen so much life on Cassatoche until I got there. The birds are constantly fertilizing the area with nitrogen from the ocean, through their guano. And the invertebrate life, the insect larvae, there are all these little what are called potworms, which are a relative of the earthworm, but they're much smaller, and there's tons of that. Those worms, there were all these different beetle species that were feeding on the dead birds or predators on other insects. Nearly every rock you turn over was happening. It was really exciting.
That is fascinating. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. On Outdoor Explorer, thanks to my guest, Derek Sykes, curator of insects at the University of Alaska Museum of the North, professor of entomology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and Janice Chumley, integrated pest management technician at the UAF Cooperative Extension Service. On the next show, Charles Woolforth will be back to talk about the Kachemak Bay Water Trail. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey, and I'm Annie Feit. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.